The Windy City of Chicago has sent a couple of folks from Chicago to the sunny skies and the sunny climate of California, and their voices and their names are very familiar to radio fans. Barbara Luddy and Olin Soleil, hello, welcome.
Hello, Chuck.
Hi, Chuck.
Welcome to you.
Boy, yeah, it's welcome.
It's nice to be out here, and it's nice to say hello to you folks.
Didn't we plan nice weather for you?
Yeah, this is super. This is great stuff. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about your careers. You folks worked together for a long time, and then,
about
of course,
years,
you...
Wasn't it?
Yeah, almost.
When did the... Barbara, were you with the first Niner program when it first went on the air?
No, June Meredith was.
Uh-huh.
At June Meredith and Jack... What? Doty?
Well, Jack Doty did it for a very short time,
and
but...
Then died,
yeah, then, and then Don Ameche.
And then, was the first. Then Betty Lou Gerson replaced June mm-hmm. Meredith, and they came out here... When Don got his Fox contract, and they
when he became Alexander Graham Bell,
yeah.
Yes, and they auditioned. First Nighter auditioned every ingenue in town to do second business for the 6 weeks they were going to be here. Betty Lou Gerson was mm-hmm. the leading lady, and I got it, and I did second business with them for 6 weeks, and then Betty Lou went back to Chicago. For the summer hiatus, and she got off the train and married Joe Ainley the very day that she got back there. So, since she had just gotten married when they went back on the air in September, she didn't want to come out here and leave him, and so they got me. And so I did it with Don Ameche for 9 months, and then we went back to Chicago. And who turned out to be our director but Joe Ainley, the man she'd given up the show for. That's right. And Les Tremaine and I did it for about 6 years, mm-hmm. and then Olin and I did it for about 11.
Well, you started, it was around 1936, wasn't
36,
it?
36,
yeah.
36, September of 36.
Uh-huh.
And I went to Chicago, and I got there the 1st of June in 37. Was there until mm-hmm. June of 46. I rounded my 9 years off nicely
yeah.
for the day.
Olin, when did you come into the first Niner scene?
In 43, really. It was just 10 years, I guess, because we came out here in 47 and went off the air in 53.
That's right.
So
that's
I did it the last 10 years it was on. Mm-hmm. I had the pleasure of being with Barbara longer than any of the other leading men.
Now, when did it come out here?
In 1947.
In 47.
Right, right.
So you both were, you spent a long time in Chicago with it.
Yeah, from 36, Biddy was there from 36 on.
37.
Huh, 37?
Yeah, I started out here in 36 with Don.
Oh.
I went back there in 37.
Oh, I see, yeah. And then Les went to New York in 42 or 3, 43, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And then I started with her. And then we came out here. I had been in
been
radio
on the
there.
Show a lot.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But you became the co-star. And
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The little theater off Times Square never
Smoking
came from
in
Times
water
Square.
Lobby
did it?
Only, please.
Never
right.
came from New York.
Never was
As a matter of fact, in our format, in the announcer's copy, at the end of the show, there was always a note which said, "Announcer, do not ad lib. This has been a Chicago origination." Because they wanted to...
And the same thing when it was out here, they were not allowed to identify it as being uh-huh. Hollywood yeah. origination.
Because they wanted the illusion of the little theater off Times
yeah.
Square in New York, of course.
Was it Eric Sagerquist in the orchestra
yes,
on the show?
Yes, right.
Oh, boy.
Till he died.
Yeah, Biddy and I went to his funeral together,
yeah,
remember?
I sure do.
Mostly, the show consisted of romantic comedies, but
mm-hmm.
every once in a while you'd get into a kind of a mystery comedy or even something a little more serious than that.
Yeah.
They tried to it went from farce through comedy to a fairly serious love stuff. Hello.
<Yeah. laughs> Love stuff.
And occasionally a mystery. They
uh-huh.
tried to vary them each month.
Was it always sponsored by Campana products?
Until the very end of it.
Until we came out here.
Until the very end of the thing out here, Campana... decided they no longer needed it on the air, and they sold it on a royalty basis or something. They still own it,
mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
to Miller High Life Beer.
Yes. And
which was strange.
Which was really strange for First Nighter, because there was never a mention of drinking. None of the ladies ever smoked.
No.
And once we said darn in a script, and we got so much mail you wouldn't believe.
Really?
From people uh-huh. saying, when you say darn, you mean damn, and that's just like swearing.
Yeah, yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah, that's right.
So when we were sponsored by a beer, that was really a step.
Campana was a family affair, the Campana mm-hmm. Company. It was close-knit. They couldn't stand it when the show came out here with Don. They couldn't stand to leave it out here. They had to have it back there in Chicago. Remember our play readings, Biddy?
Mm.
The way they selected.
I'll never forget them.
When you had to stand in the hole in the middle.
Because I'm short, and we read from our scripts were submitted by any and all writers,
uh-huh.
and then we'd
one
copy we'd have, and we had a reading each week to select which ones we would use, and I'm not quite 4'11". So I'd be right there in front by the one script.
The copy on the music stand.
And everybody had to read over my shoulders, and they were usually fairly early in the morning, I mean around 10 or so, and I don't think they had things like certs and so forth then. You used to get pretty heavy sometimes.
But that's how they would audition. Someone would listen to it and say, well, that sounds good, right?
Yeah, we'd read five or six shows at uh-huh. a time. And the committee would be in the control room there listening. Joanne Lee, our director, and Bill Krull, the president of the company, Rich
and
Krull.
And what was her name?
I was going to ask you. A dear lady.
Very nice lady who was a big wheel in the company. Uh-huh. She would always be there. And so dear Tom Wallace, who was our producer.
Oh, yeah, from the agency.
From the agency. Mm-hmm. And they would select them.
They always did a good job of selecting because everyone really liked that show. And it was... You really had, you know, that's where radio could really do it, because the sound mm-hmm. effects, the setup of it, the theater, you knew when the usher took the ticket taker took the tickets,
yeah,
and the usher
yeah.
showed you to the seat, and there was a kind of a chime or a gong on there.
That's
and
right.
Yes,
the you could
going
see
up.
The house lights dimming and the curtain going up. And
it was a complete picture.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Most people that have ever mentioned it to me always thought I was a small, a tall blonde instead of a short brunette.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
I have had so many people meet me and start to shake hands up there, and finally come down and say, well, I thought you were a tall blonde.
A lot of people had a different
tall,
idea.
Voice.
Yeah. A lot of people had a different idea of the way I looked, too, because I used to play the... handsome football heroes, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well.
And here's a good example of this. Biddy has heard this story, but it's still kind of funny, I think. When the show moved out here in 1947, we bought a home here in the valley. And naturally had to... we did move things out from Chicago, but we had to buy some extra things. And we were buying some patio furniture at the time, which we hadn't had in Chicago. And picked out the furniture, bought it, and I wrote a check for it, and the man looked at the check and he said, Olin Soule from First Nighter. And I said, yes. And I was beaming, of course, and he said, well, my goodness, I've listened to you for all these years and now to finally meet you. And he looked me over from head to toe and said, I don't mind telling you, I'm sure disappointed.
Well, that was one of the great things about radio drama, because the listener provided the pictures.
Sure.
That's right.
He built his own set,
sound.
Furnished
that's
his
right.
own wardrobe and
someone
everything.
Someone has referred to it. I wish I could give credit where it's due, but as the theater of the mind, and I believe that to be a very accurate statement.
Oh, mm-hmm. Well, the hero is always as handsome as you wanted him to be, and
that's
the
right.
heroine, too, as
yes.
pretty, and the villains and the bad guys can be
mm-hmm.
rotten. mm-hmm. Olin, did you ever play a bad guy on radio?
No.
I don't think so. I
only played one in television. I did one heavy in television, but...
What was that?
No.
I didn't see it. You should have told me.
Oh, that's a long time ago. I don't remember.
You being mean.
I don't remember.
You folks shared a lot of radio things in the Chicago area back in those good days.
Yes,
and
we did.
Did you ever get caught with the bridge up?
Yes. Oh, yes. I got caught with the bridge up. I missed shows. I didn't miss a show with the bridge up, no. I missed a show or repeat on Bachelor's Children once when... my watch stopped. I was up at the Actors Club, and somebody else had to step in and do my part on the repeat. But
you were on the Chicago Theater of the Air together.
Yes.
Weren't
mm-hmm.
you?
Yes.
The Colonel McCormick's,
Colonel McCormick's
special
pet.
Saturday night pet there.
Where he used to get to make
tales.
His speeches about the Civil War.
Yeah. And he always wore tails and was mm-hmm. such a very handsome man.
Incidentally, speaking of that, yes, he was, and a nice man. Speaking of Chicago Theater of the Air, I was doing a looping out here a while back on the other side of the mountain, I think it was. And there was a young fellow there who was the director, and he got to talking about the radio days. He was interested in the old radio days, and First Nighter mm-hmm. and various shows. And I said, well, I have a book about old-time radio performers that I'll give you, and if you'd like it. And his name was Pierce, Larry Pierce, and I said, I was going to autograph it to him. So I said, how do you spell your name, P-I-E-R-C-E or P-E-A-R-C-E? And he said, no. He said, P-I-E-R-C-E. And I said, well, it's like Larry Pierce. I mean, like, I'm killing
Sammy?
My story.
Is no, Sammy Pierce out here?
Jan Pierce.
Oh, yes.
you may have to repair this tape, like I said, you sometimes have to. Anyway, I said, that's like Jan Pierce, spelled his name. And he said, I know, that's my father. And
for
he said, I know that you used to work Chicago Theater of the Air together many years ago when he was
oh,
with
my.
Uh-huh. Metropolitan
Marion,
Opera.
Marion Clare.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you were the voice of Marion Clare when she would do the singing and you would do the acting.
Yes,
right?
And not all the time. Uh-huh. Sometimes other people, but I did it, I think, the majority of the mm-hmm. time.
And of course, there would be someone.
Yeah, we had
Pierce, for example, might be singing, and you might
right.
be doing
uh-huh.
the
dramatic cast and a singing uh-huh. cast. And we yeah. always dressed. That was white tie and tails.
Bet your boots.
You often.
We always dressed for First Nighter
yeah.
too.
Uh-huh.
In Chicago, yeah.
You betcha.
Uh-huh. Always evening clothes.
Well, that added to the illusion for the studio audience.
Sure. It made the show seem more important. I don't know. I liked it better. Now, we never did dress it out here. Things are more.
No, they were
casual and informal.
Mm-hmm.
But
sometimes I'd wear a cocktail dress and nothing but short.
Uh-huh.
There we wore long
yeah,
evening gowns, and the gentlemen were in, the minimum was tux.
Yeah, that's right.
And on New Year's Eve, it was always tails.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah? If you did once in 6 years, you might do one on
yeah.
New Year's Eve.
Christmas.
Those were all before the advent of tape and
that's
recordings.
Right.
Well, we
that's
all,
right.
We were all alive. Once there were, our show was never recorded as such, but there was a man at
Herb Johnson.
Herb Johnson, WBBM.
Had a sound effects department.
Whenever we had any one of us had a part that we considered a part that we liked especially well, we would pay him to record it for ourselves.
On uh-huh. acetate, a
on
quickie.
On acetate.
Uh-huh.
No.
Uh-huh.
And they're beginning to deteriorate.
You better get them
the
on
acetate.
Tape.
Well,
oh,
that's,
yeah.
that's what
yeah.
this
yeah.
nice man did from Spokane. He put uh-huh. them on tape. And
yeah.
Because they were beginning to get...
Yeah, you have to salvage it that way. Then
yeah.
the tape won't deteriorate that much.
That's right.
I used to have Herb take shows off once in a while, as Biddy says. And one of them was a... speaking of the bridge being up, Bachelor's Children was a show I did for a long time there, for 11 years. And as you said, we didn't have any tapes then. It was all live shows, live original show mm-hmm. and a live repeat for the West Coast. And so our first show was at 8:45, I believe, in the morning, 8:45 to 9 o'clock in the Wrigley Building, WBBM, CBS. And so a company, an agency hired me to do a 15-minute show once a week at 9 o'clock on Monday morning at WGN, which was directly across the street. And the studio was uh-huh. on the 11th
McCormick
floor.
Studio.
McCormick Studio. McCormick Studio, yeah. So I was also doing a show there at the time called Wayside Theater, which was on Sunday, and sponsored by the Chicago Motor Club. And Pat Dunlap did a lot of the leads in there with me, remember? She
yes.
played my wife in Bachelor's Children.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so I had had Herb record this Wayside Theater Sunday show, and I was anxious to hear it Monday morning. Now, mind you, I've got this show directly across the street to do at 9 o'clock, immediately following Bachelor's Children. And the way we worked it, on account of not being able to rehearse it Monday morning, we rehearsed it on Friday. Then the agency man would read, just walk through it, read for a last-minute rehearsal before it went on the air, and I came across the street and did it cold Monday morning without a rehearsal.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd had Herb record Wayside Theater, and I was very anxious to hear it.
Oh.
And after Bachelor's Children went off the air at 9 o'clock, I ran down the basement to his place there and got the record and sat and listened to it. So that afternoon, I came back for the repeat of Bachelor's Children. And Bob Bailey was sitting there.
Oh, yes.
And Bob said, you know, I heard a show this morning that you sure would have been good in. I said, oh, what was that? And he mentioned the show that I supposedly had done at 9 o'clock, and I had forgotten to go do it. So that was one of those shattering experiences.
How about those repeat broadcasts? You did the first nighter.
We didn't do repeats on first night.
Well, we did.
You didn't?
We did. Huh? One summer we did, honey.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I don't know.
I forgot.
The reason I remember it is because Tom Wallace and Joe and I would always go to a Chinese restaurant for dinner between the shows. And one time they took me to the burlesque between shows.
Did they get you in for half price? You're only 4 foot 11. They didn't have a half price at the burlesque.
I don't think so.
Olin, you were, you should be familiar with Chinese restaurants. You played a Chinese cook in Little Orphan Annie, didn't you?
My first network part.
What was the name of it?
Aha. His name was Aha, the Chinese cook, and it was very important because it was a $15 job, and I couldn't louse it up, couldn't lose it, you know. So what I used to do was go down and get a script. Naturally, they didn't write any dialogue for him. So I'd go down and get a script and write dialogue to fit the scene, and then take it to a Chinese restaurant up there on the north side and get a waiter friend up there to give me the Chinese phonetically. And I would do half-baked Chinese to make it sound important.
I didn't know that.
See? Aren't you glad you came? Now you found out something.
And I used to, after all these years.
Used to sit in our little dinette there, and we had our little Pomeranian there. And I'd sit there and practice my Chinese.
On the Pomeranian.
Which I guess was pretty scary. And he'd start backing up and barking until he'd get clear at the other side of the apartment. Couldn't stand it.
Well, if that was your first network show, Olin, what was your first experience with radio?
My first show was Uncle Quinn Scalawags.
Quinn Ryan.
Quinn Ryan.
Uh-huh.
That's right. And Mary Affleck. That's the name
Mary
that I was trying
Ashley,
to think of.
That's
Mary
right.
Affleck.
Affleck.
Affleck. Yeah, that was married to Curly Bradley there, who did Tom Mix. And Mary was the writer and director on this show. That was my very first show there. But then in getting started, I had been on the stage before, and in 1933, at the time I started in radio there, the best offer that I could get was 2 a week stock in Zanesville, Ohio for $25 a week.
Oh my word, mm-hmm.
And,
a week.
And 2 a week, and furnish your own wardrobe.
Oh.
So I said, well, we can be hungry here as well as in Ohio. So this was during the NRA, National Recovery Administration,
years.
You know. And I got a job in the office of a steel company, the Edgar T. Ward Steel Company on the south side of Chicago for $65 a month, and worked there for 6 months while I started trying to get radio auditions, mm-hmm. you see. And I'd tell all kinds of lies to get away, and one time Mr. Bothwell, the manager, in case he's listening, said, Sule, you've been gone more than you've been here. If you have to leave this time, don't come back. So that was my entry into radio.
For goodness sake.
And we had about $10 ahead at the time. And so then I started getting other jobs with Blair Walliser there and various shows.
Oh, Blair.
I don't want to talk too much here, but a crazy little story about Orphan Annie and Jack Armstrong, in which I played Coach Hardy, and these repeat shows.
Uh-huh.
Jack Armstrong was on at 3:30 and 4:30 in the Wrigley Building on Michigan Avenue. Orphan Annie was on at 3:45 and 4:45, immediately following, on the 19th floor of the Merchandise Mart.
Mm.
So Norma, my wife, used to bring a car down to the back end of the Wrigley Building, the lower level there, remember?
Yeah.
And I'd run down the steps into the car, into the cab, and over to Merchandise Mart, and the starter would shoot me up to the 19th floor, and I'd run into Orphan Annie, just as Pierre André would be droning out the last few words of his lead into Orphan Annie.
Oh,
and always made it. But that was a...
That was real
That was
close.
A crazy thing, yeah. And sometimes the parts, naturally, sometimes would come in for a run at the same time.
You also were involved in some Captain Midnight stuff and some other things, too, weren't you? In a lot of the kids' shows.
Right, I worked in Captain Midnight there with Johnny Coons, my old and dear friend there.
Yeah.
And Ed Prentice was Captain Midnight there. He's now out here. And then I worked in Captain Midnight 20 years later out here in film, incidentally. And played the same character.
I didn't know
In the
that.
TV,
yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And played
That's
the,
right, yeah.
The same character.
But they changed that to
and
Jet Ovaltine. Jackson, didn't they?
Well, that was a rerun title.
Yeah.
Jet Jackson was a rerun title.
I didn't know that. You never did let me know. I would have watched.
Didn't you know about that?
No.
Yeah, and Dick Webb out here was Captain Midnight, and Sid Melton was Icky.
Did you know he was Batman?
Yeah.
Batman?
I play Batman in Super Friends, the animated cartoon that's on Saturday mornings on ABC. I played Batman in a Batman series three or four years ago, a cartoon series.
Uh-huh.
That was just the voice.
The voice. You bridged the gap very easily from radio to television. You just kept on going and working your
I've really
feature films.
I've really been blessed with that and going one angle of it to another, one aspect of it to another, stage and radio and then pictures and television and finally commercials where the money's buried.
And, hardly a week goes by when we don't see Olin Soleil on the screen, on the TV someplace. You always... How many dragnets did you appear in?
I don't know.
You made dozens of those.
Awful lot, yeah. And do you know that as long ago as the old dragnet shows were, I still have more identification there than on anything else? More people... I'm a what's-his-name, you know, in pictures. People say, oh, there's what's-his-name. And many people probably told you this because a lot of us have the same experience. The stars are known and the supporting people, I mean the featured people in pictures and television. But a lot of us who are in some cases the mainstays of things are really not known by name.
And work more often than the name.
Although we keep busy.
Oh, yeah,
yeah
sure.
Yeah.
Well, you can adjust easily and adapt, and you're always there. And a good, solid, supporting role is a good, meaty one, too.
Yeah.
And it provides the meat, I guess.
You bet.
Barbara Luddy, you were in a lot of the soap operas in Chicago, too, weren't
well,
you?
Well, I was in Dr. Brandt and Woman in White, Erna Phillips series.
Mm-hmm.
And I was Dr. Brent's wife, and that wasn't a very good thing to be because he was always having problems. and they had to kill me in Woman in White. I was a bad girl.
Why, pity?
I was. I had an illegitimate child. And they had to kill me. The audience absolutely insisted upon it.
Really?
Yes. Erna Phillips tried to straighten the character around and make me a... after I'd had the baby, make me a responsible type character and clean me up, as it were. But the audience would have no part of it. They got so many letters saying you've got to get rid of her, so they killed me.
And there it was, the end of it. Then
Today
on television, anything goes. Just
of
about.
Course.
Well,
of course.
Oh, good gracious! The things I watch now shock me.
Yeah.
I mean, in relation to the things that we were not allowed to do.
Oh, the taboos then, or there would be nothing now at all.
We would be a real sissy type show.
Yeah.
What was your first job in radio?
My first job in radio was when I came back from Australia. I'd been over there a year. In Australia and New Zealand with Leo Carrillo.
What were you doing on the stage?
I was in the theater, yes, long before I was in theater and pictures, long before I was in radio. I came back in 1930, and we opened in San Francisco in the Bad Man. And the second week, instead of our salary, we got a notice of bankruptcy on the board.
Mm.
That was when all the theaters all over the country were closing. And so... I came back down here. This was, had been my home. And Gail Gordon and I, he was beginning to be interested in radio. I'd been away for a year, and I didn't know anything about radio, actually, except before I'd left, I'd heard a couple of Crystal sets. But as for dramatic radio, I knew nothing about it. And this one man, Carmen, I've forgotten his last name, his first name was Carmen. Oh, no, Gene Carmen, that was it, wrote a series that was based on a young couple at the breakfast table thing. And we did that at 7 o'clock in the morning for 6 months on the Bill Sharples show on KNX for free, just to break into radio, which we did eventually. Mm-hmm. We both started working with Kay Van Riper, who nobody in the East knows, but she was a magnificent writer. And she did English coronets out here that is still remembered from the 1930s. And,
yes, they are, you bet.
And she later was with MGM. She wrote the first of the Andy Hardy series. Mm-hmm. And then, and she wrote Babes in Toyland.
Arms? Babes on Broadway? Babes in Arms?
Well, it was Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland. Maybe it was Babes.
They did both, Babes in Arms and then Babes on Broadway.
Well, it was one or the other of those she wrote. She was very severely arthritic and took her life because she couldn't work. She was my best friend. That was pretty tough. But then it was after I started working with Kay, we got the regular fee was $5. And Kay would get $150. Barker Brothers was her sponsor, a big furniture company out here. And they sponsored it. And they would only pay us $5, but Kay got $150 a week for writing, directing, and starring in it. And she paid us each another $5.
She did.
Out of her own.
Out of hers.
Got $10.
So we got $10. Uh-huh. But there's a recording company out here that's doing very little now, C.P. McGregor. They about the only thing they do now is Heartbeat Theater, which is for the Salvation Army. And they still pay scale. But at that time, they paid $3 a program. And it was on wax. It was recordings.
Regular pressings.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, my word. And if anybody made the slightest error, the whole blame thing had to be done over. I remember one night we were doing a series for John Hancock Oil. Gail Gordon was the villain. True Boardman was the hero, and I was the heroine, so there. And we recorded all night long. We'd start at 10 o'clock at night and do the 5 shows for the week. And we got to the very last, we had numerous little things would go wrong, and they'd just have to shave the
wax?
Wax.
Uh-huh.
Master and start all over again. And we got finally to the very last, we had 4 in the can, and we were up to the last line of the fifth one. And Gail Gordon, as the heavy, was supposed to say, "I'll get you yet, Don Hancock." That was True's name. And he said, "Dan Hocake." Nobody was angry. Everybody was just too tired to be mad. We just collapsed all over the place. But we were there at 8 o'clock from 10 o'clock the night before.
Why would they start at 10 o'clock at night?
Well, because...
so that he'll be available, probably.
Yes.
Oh,
yes,
I see.
Because other shows were beginning then. At that time, Lux was beginning, and... And then there was Shell Chateau, and these were network things. And Lux, for instance, took 5 days of rehearsal. They paid you $50, but you actually got $10 a day.
Uh-huh.
And on Lux, it was always motion picture stars. I was one of the few exceptions. Paul Muni wanted me to... play his Mrs. Pasteur in the Louis Pasteur Lux production, and it was unheard of in those days to take a radio person, and what was that delightful man's name? Now I'm going to break down because I can't think of it. He's a European actor. He still works. He's a character man now, of course. But he was the heartthrob of the country at that time. Oh, what's his name? He has his big home and a big art gallery out in Canoga Park. You know who I'm thinking of. The letterer, Francis Letterer.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, he also liked me as his leading lady whenever he did a radio program. But other than that, they were always just the picture stars.
Well, how did they know to select you? Had they heard your work on other programs, or were you? Well, did they know you, or what?
No, they did. I didn't know either of them. But
knew your work probably.
Mr. Muni and Mrs. Muni had heard me on the English coronets.
Oh.
And I would say it was playing Lady Jane, one of Henry's wives, and. And Francis Lederer, they auditioned, and he chose me. And from then on, every time he was on, for about 3 years after that, he'd always ask for me. And one time, it was quite strange. Luella Parsons had Hollywood Hotel out mm-hmm. here, I don't know if you mm-hmm. recall it. Well, he asked for me to be his leading lady, and that was dandy. I was real pleased, because they paid $25. And it only took 2 days of rehearsal, whereas Lux paid 50, but it took five days.
Five, huh?
And which is back to the reason why we recorded at mm-hmm, night. Mm-hmm. But we rehearsed did the dress rehearsal before the show that day, and I saw this very Fifth Avenue-ish looking advertising man sitting over in a corner who had been watching me, and there was no place else to sit down but a seat next to him, so I sat there. And I said, I understand they pay $25 for the show. He said, well, you're not getting paid. I said, why? He said, because you're getting billing. they were saying, Francis Lederer starring in so-and-so, Barbara Luddy is his leading woman.
Good night.
And I said, never mind the billing. I want the money.
Now you've heard these money figures tossed around. Yeah. Now you know why we started AFRA.
That's right.
This is the reason, because of the abuses.
Yeah. When did that come in, AFRA?
1947. I mean, 1937.
Oh, yeah, it was early. Yeah,
37,
right.
Yeah.
And before that, whatever they could get you for is
$2,
what
$5, yeah. You bet.
Well, First Nighter, really I took must advantage say, of it. Sadly, when I was out here with Don, and as I say, the men had to wear dinner jackets.
Mm-hmm.
And Hans Conried was just a young boy, then he was 19, and mm-hmm. he was on, our show was the first one he was on, and he had to go out and buy a dinner jacket for that part, and he was paid $15.
Good night.
For a coast-to-coast program.
I saw Hans at the Schubert recently.
Oh, he's wonderful.
Oh, yes, I should say.
Great guy.
Olin Soleil, you were on the Grand Hotel in Chicago, too, weren't you?
Well, we did. Yeah,
we did that together.
We did. Grand mm-hmm. Hotel was the, I used to call it the Saturday format, or the daytime format.
Yeah.
Which it went on the daytime, didn't it?
Yes. We did that occasionally, but you did it more often than I. Tremaine did it more often than either of us.
Yeah.
Ann Seymour and Tremaine and Betty Lou.
But you and I did
we did it sometimes.
Grand Hotel.
We did
I don't know. I'm not too clear. It's so long ago. I just don't remember exactly.
I think it was when they were on vacation or something. The same as Betty Lou would come over to First Nighter.
Well,
when
was Grand Hotel and First Nighter on at the same time?
No. They were on at the same.
I mean, both
yes,
running the
both
same
running
week.
At the same
were
week.
They?
Yeah.
Well, I'm confused then. I know I did some First Nighters. I mean, I did some Grand Hotel.
I know you did because I did too.
Yeah.
But I was usually called in only when Betty Lou or Ann Seymour were mm-hmm. on vacation.
It was a series, kind of a dramatic anthology series, again, set around
the same type of thing,
hotel,
exactly, just, yeah. just a little different
yeah.
format, that's
yeah.
all.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I remember once I did a Mexican dialect in that, and you know me, I got a high voice and a low voice, that's it. I never tried to, we always had so many fine dialecticians, I never tried to mm-hmm. do dialects, and I had to do this Mexican in there, and Joe carried me on his back.
Joe directed that, uh-huh. too.
Taught me Spanish a word at a time.
Did either of you have to double much, use more than one
no,
voice in a program?
Not on our own shows.
Not on First Nighter.
Neither of us were ever very good at doubling, either.
The last time I had to double was about 2 years ago when I did one of these Heartbreak Theaters, Salvation uh-huh. Army things.
Mm-hmm.
And
Heartbeat, heartbreak.
Right.
Heartbeat.
However, they pay $57 now.
Yeah, we love to do those, though, because you got a good radio cast together. Uh-huh. Right? So
we see all, that's the only place we see all our old friends.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody does it for scale because it is.
Did I hear, Barbara Luddy, didn't I hear you on a 0 hour
yes,
a couple years ago,
yes,
a year and a half ago?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we both did
some of those.
Some of those
Elliot Lewis was doing them.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, however, they're off now again.
Yeah.
But when Bob Hills was doing them, they went back to the old format that Lux used to have of having picture stars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did a half hour. They changed it. How about the CBS Mystery Theater? They said that they were going to come out here to do a few shows.
They came out here and did a few. But, of course, High Brown is in New York.
Now,
he's headquartered in New York.
He wants to be.
And when he was out here, I read in Variety, I guess he was out here, and I called CBS, called one of the fellows at CBS, and I happened to be in his office at the time. I was trying to find out where to get him on the phone. So I talked to him, and I said, I know. I said, I couldn't get to everybody this time. I only did a couple of shows, and he used... Mm-hmm. Former New York people who had worked for him a lot, but he said, I'll get around to the rest of you out here next time out. But he hadn't been back, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. I'm afraid
I think they come out for 2-3 weeks, and there's a whole load of them at that time.
Yeah, but they're doing most of them, I'm afraid, in New York, and I hope we get more of them out here. Simply
I hear
because
Mary Jane Higby quite often on them.
Do you?
Yes.
Simply because a lot of us would love to do them. You know, just
would you like to get involved more with that kind of radio again today? Wouldn't it be super to do this?
Yeah, it'd be great.
Oh, great.
And,
because, as we were saying earlier, you can be anything you can sound.
Yeah, yeah.
People can build their own image.
We could do the same characters that we did then because our voices haven't changed that much.
Mm-hmm.
Physically,
right.
Changed.
But physically, right. Indeed.
So that we couldn't do them in pictures, but we could still do them in radio.
Because I'm 67 years old now, I couldn't very well play an ingenue if people could see me.
Well, you don't look like you're any age. You're still that 4 foot 11 gal. Everybody's looking over the shoulder.
With a cute little voice.
Thank you.
You must have had some good times putting all that stuff together.
We did.
Yeah, we did.
We did. We had a very, very happy. Chicago, I think, was one of the 9 years there were among the happiest of my life.
Was it different when you came out here from the radio point of view? I mean, there's always talk about the Chicago School of Radio, which I don't know what that really is, except that it was
either,
a closeness.
I came from here.
Well, of course, for so many years, I think the reason for being referred to that way is that for so many years, we originated more shows in Chicago than both coasts put together.
Right.
You know? And then things started gradually falling apart. Yeah. People wanted to go to New York or people wanted to come to Hollywood. And so it doesn't originate as many shows. Well, of course, there aren't as many radio shows, period, as there were. But we did have a fine group of people there simply because there was a lot of work there. As Biddy says, she came from here, started out here. But Chicago was the center of radio.
You better explain that. Biddy is going to sound peculiar. That's my nickname.
Nickname, Biddy.
Oh, yeah.
B-I-D-D-Y.
Yeah, we've always called her and her daughter Biddy and Little Biddy.
Only little
Barbara.
Biddy, little Biddy is 3.5 inches taller than I am.
Yeah, that's right.
Little Biddy is Big Biddy.
You're right.
Incidentally, the census is going to be on the air in Evanston. A lot of people back there will still remember this Bachelor's Children show that I mentioned that was on for 11 years. And we'll want to know where some of the people are. Hugh Studebaker, who played Dr. Bob, is out here, retired from the business. He didn't really get started in television. He didn't care much for television. He still likes radio.
Yeah.
And Marge Hannon, who played Ruth Ann in there, is no longer living. Pat Dunlap, who played Janet, my wife. I played Sam Ryder. And... Pat is now living up in Berkeley, and both Marie Nelson and Helen Van Tile, who played Ellen in there, are no longer living. Mm-hmm. So, of course, it's been a long time ago. The show was on the air from 1935 to 1946, five a week, two shows a day. And Bess Flynn, a lot of people remember her. She wrote the show. Bess is now living in Long Island, is 90 years old.
Great.
Believe it or not.
Wow, I'm just a kid.
Yeah, that's right. But I just thought I'd mention that because
wasn't your son Jack Armstrong?
Charlie Flynn played Jack Armstrong part of the time. Yeah, yeah, that's right.
You were on Jack Armstrong. Well, you were Coach Hardy, but mm-hmm. I was doing some checking up on you, and I saw the name Chandu the Magician.
Out here.
Yeah.
Were you from out here?
No, that was out here first. I did it in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
Oh.
But it was out here first before we did it there. There was Connie Osgood, Howard Hoffman. He was Chandu. Connie was the mother. I was the son.
You were the Dorothy Regent's son?
I think so. That's a little go. I can't remember much about it.
Do you remember the sponsor?
No. It didn't have a very long run.
Chandu ran out here for 5 or 6 years.
But I think that was before we did it in Chicago.
Wasn't it? Yes, I'm sure it was.
Yeah.
Because it was an
entirely different cast.
It started in about 32 or so.
They did a repeat of it. Just as they did a repeat of I Love a Mystery. You know, Carlton Morse's story was done in 39 and 40, and then they went again maybe 48 and 49 and redid the whole thing with a different cast.
Yeah, and I
think Chandu was the same way. It was out in the early 30s, and then in the middle to late 40s, they came back with the same thing again.
Yeah.
With another cast. Of course, you would have been in the original. Would you have been in the...
in the original run, second cast,
I think.
Yeah.
Well, you folks were both very well cast in the great days of radio, and I know you're
loved it.
From what you've been saying, you're still doing some things today on radio and television and in the movies. And what's next? What's the next for both of you?
I don't know. We never know from day to day.
The telephone rings and then boom, right?
Yeah.
That's right. I've done quite a bit of work for Disney. I did Lady and Lady and the Tramp. And those things I love to do because they're, again, the voice.
Yeah.
And I'm currently Kanga in Winnie the Pooh. And
are you?
All three of those. Roo is my baby and Kanga. And I played Meriwether in The Little Fat Blue Fairy in Sleeping Beauty and Nanny Cook in 101 Dalmatians. So I've worked quite a bit for Disney.
Oh, yeah. That's great.
And about every 7 years, I get a new set of people who know me because about every 7 years they bring Lady and the Tramp out again.
Yeah, yeah.
And then kids who weren't born. Well, I started doing it in 1953, and I think it took us 5 years to do it before it was completed. But it's come around 3 or 4 times.
Yeah.
And every time some little kid in the building that never heard of me will say, "Hey, I heard somebody who sounded like you."
Yeah, a new set of fans.
Yeah. Oh, that's marvelous, though.
It's great. It really is. Yeah. They've sold Winnie the Pooh to television, and so that's nice because residuals come from that. But they can play it in the theater till hell freezes over.
You don't get anything from that.
It was made for the for that medium.
Yeah.
It's when they make it for one medium and sell it to another, then is when they have to pay you. Like I made Lost Flight. A very small part of it, of a nun, with Lloyd Bridges and Anne Francis in 1968, and it was made as a pilot for a CBS series. Mm-hmm. But it was about that time that there was a great big to do about violence in TV, and it's much more violent now than it was then.
Mm-hmm.
But CBS didn't buy it for that reason. Well, they sold it to a motion picture for theatrical release to Motion Pictures. And I got a whopping big check. Scared the daylights out of me because they had made it for TV and then sold it elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And then they eventually started running it as a, well, they run it a couple times a year now as a TV movie, and I get residuals from that.
Yeah, yeah.
Very handy indeed.
Well, it's nice when the old Mr. Postman drops a little letter like that in the door.
Yes. In fact, I did one dragnet, and I have had something like 15 residuals.
Yeah, they just keep running them.
And you've done so many dragnets.
That's great.
Well, you've done so much to entertain so many people over the years in radio and television and the movies, and we're glad to have this chance to chat with Barbara Luddy and Olin Soule on the I guess this might be the outer lobby of the little theater way off Times Square.
Way off, Jeff.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Our pleasure. Thank you.
It's been a delight to talk to you.